held in July, and we've gone through the Frank Press visit and Lester Wolf's presence.
And my schedule shows that we have all set. The second meeting in the negotiations with Bon Hoa was held very quickly on July 14, but it was a very short session because my date book shows that I saw him at 3:30 in the Great Hall, and at 4:30 I was back with David Grease, who was our station chief, meeting him in the liaison office. And as we were putting out as our position point by point, and in all of these meetings, until the meeting that was held in November, all Bon Hoa ever did was to recite their full position and make no comment on the particular new item that we were presenting.
Now, as I recall, I don't remember the sequence, but we had three particular issues that we laid out in sequence in your next three sessions. Do you recall precisely what the three were?
Didn't the first one have to do with the what presence we'd have on the island?
Right. Level of representation on Taiwan.
Right.
And that we assured them that the level of representation would be non-governmental and unofficial.
Then it went from that to...
We would have to retain a full range of cultural, economic, and other relations with Taiwan.
And that went to the question of the treaties.
That's right. And then how we would, and the third issue was how we intended to terminate the treaties.
Well, we indicated we'd have to have, in most cases, equivalent arrangements.
That's right.
And we put considerable emphasis on the treaty involving the nuclear relationship and how it was in our joint interest to keep that, to ensure that it would be for the development of the nuclear proficiency would be for peaceful purposes and not for military purposes, to which, of course, Bon Hoa never gave any affirmative reaction. Continued to insist they all had to be terminated, and anything else was improper. And of course, well, we can get to that when we get into the final stages, because these items, as such, were never addressed, and couldn't have been addressed really, because we had stated our intention and our purpose, and the fact that in the concluding stage there was no response made that the obvious way to go.
Well, what we did, without stating it, was to indicate that we too had three principles, but we never stated them as principles. That would, it seemed to me, would raise the Chinese hackles. But if we don't want to use the word principles, we had needs, and we could not normalize without sensing that those needs would be fulfilled, and we have just now touched on them. Of course, the other was the other need was to issue a unilateral statement that they would not contradict, and we addressed concerning our expectations about the future of Taiwan. I believe we only broached that subject, though, at the time that you tabled the draft communique.
Yeah, they responded in that area in the meeting on December 4th through Han Yen.
That's right. One other point that may be worth recalling is that in the presentation on the maintenance of unofficial relations with Taiwan, you did indicate to the Chinese that we could not fully adopt the Japanese formula. We would have to seek legislation. And they, therefore, were apprised beforehand that Congress would become involved in the process.
That was made very clear.
Do you think that it was stated to them, as you recall, that the process of securing congressional consent and securing necessary legislation was a somewhat unpredictable process?
My memory is a little vague on that. I don't think we put emphasis on the fact that it was an unpredictable process, but that it was a separate, under our system of government, it was a separate power, and would be a co-determinant as to what finally came out. But again, in the concluding stages, little interest was expressed on the Chinese side in that aspect of it.
I wonder at this point whether you would care to read into the transcript what these meetings were like. I presume that each had its own form. And where did you meet? Who was present on the Chinese side? Who was the interpreter? You took with you, to start with, Stape, and you were a note taker. Isn't that right?
No, in the first meetings, just Stape and I went.
And then later you were joined by a third.
Later we took my secretary.
Name?
Lois Tepas.
Uh-huh.
T-E-P-A-S. But that was, I don't think that happened before the meeting in which we presented the communique.
Now, how did our instructions come to you?
Well, they came from the White House. What do we call that channel?
It was the Alpha. We called it the Alpha Channel.
Alpha Channel. I think we in Peking called it the Back Channel. But it came in over the through the CIA communications and the regular communications people in the liaison office did not see any of that traffic, either incoming or outgoing.
So it was agency personnel.
Right.
And then did David see it, or did it, was it, do you know?
He certainly had every opportunity to see it. Whether he did, in fact, I don't know.
We'll have to ask him when he comes on the third.
If he did, he was very discreet about it because he never gave any indication. I'd be inclined to think maybe he didn't. But it
he
would
did
be
not.
Interesting to ask.
I asked later. Jim Lilly indicated to me that he sensed something was going on, because he did not see the content, but he knew of the frequency with which the back channel was used, and he knew that the number would go up. He told me he'd see these communications, and he felt certain that something was going on.
Right.
Now, you met where, at the Great Hall of the People?
I was just trying to remember if the initial meetings were not in the Foreign Ministry. I think, yes, they were. The initial meetings were in the Foreign Ministry.
Downstairs, as you come in, you go to off to the right, or did you go to the Foreign Minister's office?
No, on the second floor, there's a fairly large room where the more formal meetings would be held.
And did you sit across a green felt table, or was it in these two soft armchairs?
Side by side with a small table between the two chairs. The meetings with Deng Xiaoping, of course, were all in the Great Hall.
Yeah, we'll come to those later. Now, was Nancy Tong still serving as the interpreter, do you remember?
She must have been.
Mr. G was not involved.
Nope.
I know that.
Nope. Wong Hai-rung would have been involved, and Nancy Tong.
Lin Ping? Did Lin Ping or Zhu Jijun? Do you remember those two?
Lin Ping was... He was out of commission for quite a while. Whether he was there in the first couple of meetings, he may well have been. But he had an accident and fallen and broken several teeth in his mouth. In fact, his colleagues used to joke about it. And then he went as the, he was then named as the ambassador to Australia, so that he was not involved. Wong Hai-rung and Nancy Tong disappeared from the process.
They disappeared at the end.
They were gone when we had the meeting of December 4th.
Right, with
Han Yanlong, because Zhang Wenjin was there.
I have asked Yao Wei about that. I'll talk to you about that when we get to that point.
Okay.
They were opposed to normalization, is what Yao Wei and Ji Chaozhu told me this summer.
Who was opposed to normalization?
Nancy Tong and Wong Hai-rung. Now, that's what I was told. And another vice minister, while we're on the subject, another vice foreign minister, Yeo Jan, Y-U-C-H-A-N, who did see Americans by Tupperdish, usually in his discussions of the United States, rather acerbic. Always insisted.
What was his name?
Yeo Jan.
I don't think I ever met him.
No, he did not have responsibility for American policy. He was more involved in Soviet policy. But he sought a position of equidistance, hostility to both.
I see.
Very suspicious of the United States. So you went in, and then you read from your statement?
His response would be, and this was true of all of them until the communique was presented, you know what our position is, and then to make sure that we knew, he recited.
Did he read from notes?
I think he had them with him, not necessarily reading from them. It was not a lengthy, the four conditions, the four principles, and some amplification.
And then what, did state then stay behind to go over the presentation and make sure they got it precisely?
We did that while we were all still there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there'd be some calling back after we got back to the liaison office to clarify some points. But they were very short meetings and not very complicated.
Yeah, that's worth saying, that your instructions, your instructions were brief. These were not lengthy presentations that you had to make. It normally would have taken 5 to 8 minutes and no more to read the whole thing out. And much of it repetition, because as we built the record, you went back.
We had to repeat to make sure that they didn't think our silence meant that we weren't serious about it.
That's right. Also, they got in the habit of distorting what we had said in the previous session. Do you recall that? That
yes.
They, on whether we acknowledge the Chinese view that there is but one China and Taiwan was part of it, or rather whether we were recognizing that on our own that there was but one that China and Taiwan was part of it. That they diddled with, and a couple others, as I recall, that they introduced
right.
changes in what we had said, so we had to go over.
Which is an old negotiating technique, of course. But they were really very uneventful meetings during all the time that we were putting our case on the record.
On our side, the process was roughly as follows, that after we had a meeting, we'd get the reporting cable from you. The president was intensely engaged and became even more so as the process unfolded. We would then move on to the next issue. The first instructions were drafted only by Dick Holbrook and myself, and then Vance Brzezinski went over them and they went to the president. When we began the second presentation, we realized that, and we began to see the issue of how to terminate the treaty, the Defense Treaty of Taiwan, looming ahead. We realized this, we had best have legal counsel. Tsai certainly realized that. So he brought Herb Hansel in,
right.
So that those three worked on it. That was
Brownell,
not on the instructions, but he was consulted on the issue of how
right.
to terminate.
Right.
And quite importantly, Vance went off, discussed this with Brownell and with one other former Republican. It could have been, I don't remember who it was, but a respected Republican who decided he did not want to get involved. But also recommended, as Brownell did, termination by the terms of the treaty. That's when you came in October.
Right. We had breakfast at Brownell's apartment on the same day that we went to the Chinese UN mission.
Right.
That night.
Did you and Vance go? Was that the...
Yes. Who else? Were you there?
No, I was not. Dick may have been.
Yeah, there was someone else than the two of us. Must have been Dick. Dick Holbrook, right?
Yeah. But I just want to recount the process on the White House side. Then Herb began to be involved in the drafting. We would go through three or four drafts. I have on file in Atlanta each draft that we went through in sharpening of the wording. Then they were submitted to Vance and Brzezinski and then the president. And the president, by the third session, would drop whatever he was doing to immediately edit it. Zvig would send it to him, and we would get it on his outbox in 2 hours. And with the detail, with grammatical changes, he introduced stylistic changes. This was usually after we had drafted a presentation and gotten your thoughts, and then put the two together, went to him. And he was just absolutely totally engaged by about the third session. I remember one time, this was with the draft communique, in fact, in the November. It was the cable was put together in November, although you only delivered it in December. And I walked it across to Zvig in a special envelope. We had all this very secret stuff. And I then walked, and I had a meeting with academics in the State Department. And I got back, walked over to the State Department, which is, what, 15-minute walk. And as soon as I got there, I got a telephone call. The president's already read it.
It must have really been uppermost in his mind.
Well, he had. I think it was a pleasant diversion because he had Iran, he had the Camp David problems upon him, he was involved in SALT, he had a number, but I think that this was just fun, I think it probably, and something where he could see he could actually do something. And I also think that the way we were handling it encouraged his confidence that as time went on that there were no leaks. And that he had a good man on the scene.
That was very important to him, the fact that it was kept
right.
On a confidential basis.
That's right. Well,
I note that I mentioned that my son was there. As I mentioned earlier, my son was visiting with a friend of his during this time. And we went to Datong to see Buddhist caves, which are certainly well worth seeing. But while we were there, we also asked if we could go down a coal mine, which was agreed to. I am no expert on mining technology. We went deep into the bowels of the earth, a very considerable distance. Sharon went too. Face was getting paler and paler the deeper we went. And then we walked in this tunnel with the water cascading down the sides and very uneven floor. There was a big, burly Chinese with us who was in some supervisory capacity. When the going got really difficult as far as being able to see and keeping your footing. He didn't pay any attention to poor Sharon. He took me by the arm and made sure that I was all right. And I'm sure that this was one of their better coal mines, but my impression was that the technology there was like the factories some decades behind. And also, of course, we went into the tunnels, which are beneath all Chinese cities. And the young lady who was explaining the purpose of these tunnels in the event of attack, the people could come down, how fast they could come in. And my son and his friend pursued the poor woman beyond the bounds of diplomatic nicety about where will the food be and all the rest of it, until she got quite exasperated because it was obviously the whole thing was really very impractical. Reminded me of when Winston Churchill, the grandson, came to China, and we visited. He said he'd been in China, and when they were digging these tunnels after the 69 border clashes, and he met with Zhou Enlai. And he says that he remarked to Zhou Enlai that these tunnels were quite remarkable, but they were no protection against a nuclear attack, probably no real protection against a decisive aerial attack of any kind. And that Zhou Enlai said, "Well, that may be true, but can you think of a better way to mobilize the masses?" In other words, the national effort to against the tunnels in Datung, and that young woman's exasperation, because they kept pressing her with questions to which there literally were no answers. And I see hosting a luncheon for Victor Lee from Stanford.
Oh, that. Victor Lee was, I remember that. Victor Lee was out there. That was a Stanford policy study group, right?
Right.
They tried to intervene in the normalization discussions. Do you know about that story?
No,
I'll tell you
no.
That story. They wanted to be very helpful. They were out there to talk to Hao Dejing and all. They had an idea that maybe it would be possible to normalize relations with China and keep our defense treaty with Taiwan, sever diplomatic relations, withdraw all our military forces, but still have a defense treaty.
Which the Chinese would view as being in their interest.
That's right, exactly. And these were lawyers who were going to make the case. They were going to try and be helpful to the administration, that they could make the case that our legal reasoning was wrong, that we could in fact have a defense treaty with an entity we did not recognize. I told them, for Christ's sake, you don't understand that condition is one of the best conditions we got. Who wants the damn defense treaty? This is one treaty that we should not have. Let's use any excuse to get rid of it.
Exactly.
Oh, my colleagues.
And I see on August 1st, Chai Zemin and his wife came to pay a courtesy call just before he left for the United States. And asked for my advice as to what he should do, and said the obvious things, but also to I emphasized two things: to try and make as many useful contacts in the Congress as possible on both sides of the aisle, pointing out that their Taiwan counterparts really worked very diligently and very effectively at that, and also to see as much of the United States as possible, which certainly I think you'll agree he has done.
He has done, yes.
And then the day after, said goodbye at the airport to 29 Chinese journalists who came to the United States at that time.
That was an important delegation,
right.
High level. NCNA, actually there were two delegations that came simultaneously. One was an NCNA
right.
Delegation, and another was just editors, I think.
Yes. And then Chai Zemin left with the journalism group. Well, that is the second group. No. I gave a dinner for the journalists, and then they went on a special plane to Vancouver on the 5th of August.
Now, recreate for me the Peking transportation situation at this time. When did JAL start to fly? Was there already flight between Tokyo and Peking at
that
this time?
That was already operating when I got there. between Tokyo and Peking that was JAL, was Iran Air, CAAC, of course, Pakistani Airlines. That was all, I guess.
So that was all there from the start.
Right. Now, JAL had limited flights. And not long after this, certainly after they concluded the Peace and Friendship Treaty, the Chinese wanted to increase the number of flights, but the Japanese were reluctant to, because of certain other problems that don't come back to my mind. Then on August the 11th, had the third session with Wang Hua, and the same sort of procedure. A little bit longer because we had two items to cover now, the new one plus recitation of the other, but the response always exactly the same. And I see Marshall Coyne was visiting China again. Had a very close relationship with Wang Jun, dating back, of course, from his 6 years as head of the Chinese liaison office in Washington.
This was a time of burgeoning American trade on China, with China, increasing numbers of businessmen.
Yes.
The relationship was really beginning to broaden very rapidly at this time.
Many, many business groups, because they still had not blown the whistle on themselves on the 10-year plan, with the 10 Dachings and the 120 major industrial projects and this estimated $600 billion worth of capital goods imports by 1985, so that everybody was coming there for their piece of the pie. I know, for example, at 4:30 on August 17th, I met with Fred Hartley, chairman of Union Oil. Fred Hartley is a very salty character. I had known him, not well, casually in the U.S. His colleagues must have had him on tranquilizers, because he was so low-key and on his very best behavior. But he was simply one of many, many major American executives who came, and they were mostly the top officers. Henry
yes.
Ford came. Tom Murphy was then chairman of the board and chief executive officer of General Motors, and
president of IBM, Carey, was it?
Right.
Came.
And there was a very large number of.
Did you routinely see most of those people?
Most of them, yes.
And what would they do, come by the embassy for a 30-minute chat, or?
They'd come by for, like Fred Hartley came for a discussion, usually to tell us what they were doing. In the case of Henry Ford, gave a luncheon for Tom Murphy and those that, mostly because of our past associations. But most of them made contact. And it was very useful to us to have some better notion of what was going on.
Did John Thomas play any kind of a role in trying to dampen enthusiasm? Bill Thomas.
No. Why do you ask that?
Well, I just wonder, because take Bethlehem Steel or a number of others really were carried along by this enthusiasm. And I've always been curious what role the liaison office saw as appropriate to counsel.
Both Bill and I were very skeptical of these grandiose plans.
I know he was. That's what I raised that.
And so was I. And we would make this skepticism clear. But for my part, and I think, well, you know how these things go. So somebody is coming, and you invite Bill Thomas in as head of the economic section. And unless you direct a question directly to him, he just sits there. But I would emphasize that although this is these plans are bordering on fantasy, there is a future here, and it has to be worked at carefully and slowly, and that the eye should be on the possibility of smaller projects, and that I think is the Chinese obviously got word of this, because in my farewell visit with Deng Xiaoping, he, talking about the economy, he mentioned that there was a time you seemed to know more about our economy than we knew ourselves, and smile, laugh. But Bill worked, and his staff worked pretty hard at doing what could be done to assist, and, you know, we could assist in ways that were unique to China, affording a copying service or just simple services that either were not available at all or only after with great weights and so on. So that we had a closer relationship than would be the normal case. I note on the same day that I met Fred Hartley, the Thomases gave a businessman's dinner to at their apartment, which I attended. And he was, he and his staff were very good in that regard.
He really, I have great respect for Bill. He has he enjoys being in a Chinese cultural environment, clearly, as more than most, I would say.
See, I first met Bill before I went to China. I went through my preparatory period in the summer of 77. And he had then applied for his third year. And so all the rest of the stuff I'd heard was how you'd be lucky to last 18 months. Mm-hmm. So I naturally said to him, why are you asking for a third year? His answer is, and this was also typical Bill Thomas, his answer was, well, the work is not arduous and the living is easy. I expected this as somewhat, but that's typical Bill. I must say that it gave me a first impression of him, which was a little skeptical. But that quickly disappeared. I found him one of those most useful when I got there. Then in late August, I went to the Naval Hospital at Yokosuka to get the examination that I talked about earlier. Stayed in the Togo suite in the officers' club at Yokosuka, which is sort of a little shrine. This is not the Togo of
the war period.
The war period. This was an Admiral Togo who would die before the beginning of difficulties. between the United States and China. Now, by this time, of course, the Japanese and Chinese had concluded the Peace and Friendship Treaty. And I remember that President Carter's statement, public statement, about the anti-hegemony clause was most helpful to them. How did that come about?
It's big.
Really?
That's big. Was eager to push that along, as you can guess.
Right.
And
well, we talked about that, as I remember it, when you were all there in May.
That's right. And Big talked about it on his way back when he was in Japan. In addition, Carter talked about it to the Prime Minister when the Prime Minister visited Washington in 78, privately.
Well, didn't he, on that occasion, make some public... There was something on the public record that was useful to the Japanese in finding a way to do that.
I confess I do not remember the details, but I know he
I think it was in connection with the Prime Minister's visit. There's all sorts of Chinese delegations going and coming. And see many receptions. The PRC coal mining survey delegation, which had either just was just about to go or just come back from the U.S. We had a joint reception for them and the U.S. engineering education delegation. Next night, U.S. Petroleum Independence Group, with their Chinese counterparts, a reception totaling 80 U.S. Petroleum IND, must have been Petroleum Industries, maybe suppliers and so on.
This is through the National Council?
Possibly. But this was it was now becoming routine, despite the lack of normalization, to have these joint receptions where the Chinese would come in considerable numbers. Stephen Fitzgerald, the former Australian ambassador, came by with his brother-in-law to have breakfast. American Society of Newspaper Editors hosted a luncheon. This was a group of about 16 with some fairly influential
they had an interview
newspapers
with, represented. Did they have an interview with Deng? Do you remember? I think they did.
I don't know.
And what? Well, now you're at the time when Ambassador Chai arrived in Washington.
Right.
He was to call on the president very early, but the president then went up to Camp David. And Camp David had just been completed by mid-September. His Big and Cy Vance had seen Chai, and I believe we got an appointment with him, with Mondale, but he had not yet seen the president. Finally, the president saw him on, what was it, the
19th of September.
And a memorable meeting. Now, I don't remember what readout we gave you of that meeting. We certainly did not cable the text of the conversation to you, did we?
Yes, I had that.
You did?
How did I get it?
Then we sent it to you full back channel. That's right, we did. We sent you, now I remember, we went over the text and then sent it back channel for your information as to what had transpired.
I remember being so impressed with how well it was worded, and it had not been in his talking points as I understood it.
Not at all.
It was a really masterful job.
Oh, it was one of his most impressive performances. What he did is...